Welcome to episode 258 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I'm your host, Ian Martin, and today we're going to be talking to one of the rising talents in British alpine ski racing. Plus, we're going to discuss whether the future of snow sports is one where we have ski lifts, but no cables. We also have snow reports from Australia and New Zealand and your feedback. Now, as you might guess, this podcast takes a huge amount of time to produce, so I'd like to thank Tyrol for choosing to sponsor the Ski Podcast. It means I can keep producing episodes and that we all have a chance to find out about some of the great destinations in Tyrol. There are over 80 resorts and 3,400 kilometres of ski runs, and this winter we're going to be finding out more about them all. Let's meet this week's guests. Both the first timers on the show. Firstly, I'm delighted to welcome GB slalom skier Rhys Bell. Hi, Rhys. How are you?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me today.
It's a pleasure. Whereabouts are you, Rhys?
I'm currently in Eagle, Colorado at my house.
And I really appreciate you getting up early. I think it's about 7 in the morning. I asked you in the green room what the weather's like, but am I right in saying the sun hasn't even come up yet?
Yeah, it's just starting to come up.
I don't really know where Eagle is. I have to be honest with you. Is that up in the mountains?
Yes, it's about half an hour away from Vail.
So fantastic location. Also joining us today is the CEO of Amana, a fascinating startup we're going to be finding out more about later on this episode. It is Dennis Hettema. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Ian. Thank you so much for having us.
Now, I can see that you're in your car at the moment. Whereabouts are you?
I am somewhere in Germany, not quite sure where, but I decided to pull to the side of the roads.
I should let listeners know that Dennis and I have actually met in person. You know, often I meet people when we're recording the podcast and then meet them later in real life. But in Dennis's case, some of our regular listeners will know that I curated the forum for Ski Launch last month, about a month ago now. And the story of Amana, which we're going to come on to a little bit later on, was so interesting that I invited him on to one of the panels there. So it's nice to see you again, Dennis, although always better to see you in real life. Now, a question I always like to ask my guests to start off with is, when did you ski or snowboard last? So let's turn to you, Rhys. When were you last on snow?
I was last on snow on August 12th, and I was in Saas-Fee skiing on the glacier.
Not that long ago. And I would I be right in saying at that time most of the GB Alpine team were out there, because I think Dave Riding and Laurie and Billy were training in Saas-Fee. Is that right?
I think they were just about to arrive. I think they were starting a little bit later, like the beginning of September. So I didn't end up seeing any of the male British team, but there was Molly Butler and the Carrick Smiths were there at the same time.
Okay, we haven't had an update from the Carrick Smiths on the show for a while. I'm not sure if you're aware, but Ski Podcast sponsors them. But I know that, Saas-Fee, very popular place to train in the summer. And I think I'm right in saying that Zermatt have restricted their glacier to Swiss skiers only these days. So the format for that, if I recall correctly, is you get up very, very early in the morning and then get to ski gates until it gets too warm to make it worthwhile. Is that how it works?
Yep, that's a pretty accurate summary. There were some days when I was waking up at 3:50, which feels more like the middle of the night than early morning.
I think it is.
Taking the early morning lift, and the sun is just about rising as you start skiing, which is pretty nice, but it's hard to get your sleep schedule on the right track.
I bet it is. I mean, I went to Saas-Fee in the summer one year and skied on the glacier. And as I was going up to go skiing at what I thought was a relatively early time in the morning, all the racers were coming back down, having done their sessions for the day. What about yourself, Dennis? When were you last on snow?
I was thinking about that before we were going to chat. And I thought it was the Three Valleys in April, but it was actually Black Mountain in New Hampshire in March, April. There was a event by IndiePass, Eric Mogensen, also the founder of Etabeni. He bought Black Mountain, and like the entire mountain was green, but somehow he had managed to produce snow all the way to the top. So there was this one, you know, very, very narrow line of snow. And yeah, I maybe got like 8 or 10 runs in, but it was great. And you know, his chairlift was an experience. It's like a 14 minute ride up, and a chairlift that was maybe built in the 80s or 90s or something like that.
I think that's the first time Black Mountain has been mentioned on the Ski Podcast, and we've covered a lot of different areas. Certainly the Indy Pass has been mentioned a lot of times, and we're going to be discussing that again later this season, but we'll come to that later. The ski season itself is drawing to a close down under now in Australia, New Zealand, Chile and Argentina. But it looks like, thanks to some great snowfall, that season could go on, I don't know about for another month, but certainly during October. So let's have a listen to the latest update from Miss Snow It All, Rachel Oakes-Ash from snowsbest.com, and also a report from Guy Beatson, who finished off his season with a week at Whakapapa on the North Island.
Thanks, Ian. It's the closing weekend for a stellar Aussie ski season down under, though Charlotte Pass and Selwyn Snow have already shut up shop a couple of weeks ago. Resorts have received some fresh snow this week, so there'll be spring turns to close the winter out. Thredbo will celebrate the closing long weekend with the traditional Ponderskim in all manner of fancy dress, and Hotham in Victoria will do the same with their newly titled Bird Bath event. And it's party shirt weekend at Perisher with all manner of loud retro attire. Across the ditch, Wanaka's Treble Cone and Queenstown's Coronet Peak closed for the season last weekend, though the Remarkable still has another week to go. And Cardrona's annual Bikes on Snow will close out the season this Sunday with mass two-wheel mayhem on snow. Further north, Mount Hutt still has 2 weeks left of the season. And on the North Island, Whakapapa and Tauroa will finish up on October 26.
Well, we're close to the end of the line for another New Zealand ski season. I just got back from the Scout National Snow School on Mount Ruapehu, and I have never been wetter on a ski area in my life. Through the rain and the slush, the scouts and venturers were amazing, going from nervous first-timers to linking turns down the slope. The last fortnight has been a classic spring roller coaster. We've seen rain at lower elevations, freeze-thaw conditions giving us icy mornings and slushy afternoons, and a rapidly receding snow base from Mount Hutt to the southern lakes. Most club fields have already packed it in. This coming weekend will be the last hurrah for places like Treble Cone and Cadrona, while Mount Hutt is battling to stay open into early October and beyond. Warm nor'westers mean that what's left of our winter snowpack in the South Island is disappearing fast. In the North Island, the forecast shows more rain, but also snow to low elevations in the next few weeks. Tauroa and Whakapapa on Mount Ruapehu just might make it to their forecast close in the third weekend in October. So it's getting close to the time to hang up the boots and start thinking about summer. It's been a season of highs and lows, from cold winter storms to those challenging spring thaws. But as always, it was worth every single run. Time to slap on the storage wax and start the countdown to the New Zealand winter 2026.
If you enjoyed listening to our Best Skis of 2026 episode, then make sure you subscribe so you don't miss next week's Best Ski Boots episode. Now, if you'd like to see what Al and I look like, don't forget you can watch these special equipment episodes on the Skipedia YouTube channel. And if you want to meet us in real life, it's now only 2 weeks until the London Snow Show, when we will be presenting on the equipment stage with tips on how to choose your kit and what to look out for at the show. That is on the Saturday at 10:45, just after the show opens. And then later on, I'll be talking about how to drive an EV to the Alps. On Sunday, Chemi Alcott will be quizzing me about my ski touring trip to Mount Etna earlier this year. But there's way, way more going on than that, including the chance to meet Dave Riding and the current Smith brothers, for that matter. And so if you're near London, the dates are 18th to 19th of October. And you can get free tickets by taking the link in the show notes. So just have a look for that. Right, Rhys, we're going to move on to you now. I imagine long-time listeners will recognise your name. The Bell family has a long history in British racing. Your father, Martin Bell, he recorded what I think is still the best ever Olympic result, eighth in the downhill at Calgary in 1988. Your uncle, Graham Bell, been on the show a number of times before, took part in five Winter Olympic Games. So with that kind of background, I guess my first question has to be, does that make it more difficult for you with the knowledge of, you know, their careers? Or does it make it easier thanks to the experience that, you know, your father and your uncle can help you with?
I would say it actually makes it easier, because especially talking with my dad, he has very good knowledge of the steps that you need to take to progress up and to get into the World Cup top 30. And it's just been really cool to sort of get another perspective and to keep things in perspective for me, because sometimes it's pretty challenging and he's always had some really good advice.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I think he was your original coach. when you first learn to ski, useful to have an Olympian teaching you. Evidently, you can create your own legacy because, you know, you're doing very well already. You know, you've had success as a junior. I think I was looking around, you won the US Under 16 National Championships, British Under 18 National Championships. And then last year at the World Championships in Saalbach, you took 20th. I think you gained 7 places on the second run there. How did that one feel?
I was very happy with my result in Saalbach. I wasn't really aware of my second run, and I knew that I was moving up places, but it wasn't until I checked one of my friends' phones and I saw that I had had some pretty fast splits at the top part of the run. The rest of the experience had felt a little bit surreal, but then when I saw that, I was just super happy, and I was really happy to share the moment with my family, who never really gets to watch me ski, and they happened to be watching me for the first time in 3 or 4 years there. So it was, yeah, just a really special day.
I bet it was indeed. As you say, having your family there can make a lot of difference. I already referred to the fact that Martin, your father, was your coach when you're younger, and you obviously learned to, I say it's obvious, you learned to ski young. You've lived in the States for all of your life, I think, because Martin's worked as an ambassador for Vail first and then Big Sky. Is that where you started your skiing?
Well, I actually started when I was 3, and that I was just skiing around Beaver Creek. And then I started racing in Big Sky when I was about 8.
You know, I'd love to go to Big Sky. We have featured it on the podcast before, but it looks like such a fantastic area. One of the largest in America, I think.
Yeah, I think Big Sky is an amazing mountain. And I don't think that I'd be the skier I am if it wasn't for that, because something that my dad was very big on when I was younger is doing as much time on the mountain and out of the gates as in the gates. And I don't know, it just gave me like a wider skill set, I think. It was just an amazing place to ski. I definitely want to go back soon.
Cool, I like that. I remember talking to Zoe Atkin, another Brit who's based in the States, who's saying how much she enjoys actually not just skiing freestyle, but doing what you might call real skiing, you know, as well, and how much pleasure you can take from that. We mentioned that you started skiing young, and you're 24 now. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Considering your age, you've had your share of injuries. Again, I was doing a bit of research, and it looked to me like you've had like 2 ACL injuries before you were even 21.
Yes, that's true. Especially in, I'd say, my first 2 years of FIS, I've had a shoulder injury. The second year I was out with an ACL. Then I had a couple good years, and then I had a repeat ACL, which was a very challenging injury just due to the timing. I had just started my first World Cup, and I was supposed to do a few more that season, and I was skiing pretty well. So that was just a hard one to get my head around. It ended up sort of dragging on because I had like knee problems since then, but I've been working on managing it with my training and with my dry land training.
So dealing with the recovery from ACL injuries is pretty challenging. I think most skiers, a lot of skiers have done that. Martin, your father, had the same injury in his career. So you were talking about before how his advice has, you know, been helping you down the pathways. Was he able to help you with specific advice for recovering from that as well?
Honestly, I'd say that the surgery has changed a bit from when he had it. For example, he didn't even know what sort of graft he had, which is, I think, is kind of funny, because for me, the surgeon was always telling me, like, we have to take from your patella, it's the strongest graft. So like specifics, he wasn't able to give me too much, but just general encouragement, he was really helpful for, because I'd say since he went through it, he understands like it's a challenge, but you can get through on the other side and get back to full racing.
Yeah, I mean, keeping that positive attitude is so important. I imagine that you're spending a lot of time doing your rehab, but also in training as well. When you are training, outside of being on the slope itself and focusing on the gates and things like that, what kind of training are you doing in the gym or cardio? What do you like to do there?
Well, where I live in Eagle, it's great for mountain biking. It helps skiing a bit because you have to be pretty focused and balanced, and you have to know how much you want to risk certain turns. For strength training, I'm doing a lot of stuff just focused on strengthening my knees and strengthening my tendons, especially the patella tendon, because in both of my ACL injuries, they actually took part of the material from the patella tendon, and it has given me a few problems in the past, but as long as I'm on top of it in the gym, it doesn't hurt when I'm skiing. So I'd say that's probably the most important off-season training I can do.
Do you do a lot of kind of explosive work? Because, you know, as a slalom athlete, while cardio I guess is important. I mean, you talk about, you know, 2 minute bursts of energy, or even less than that, actually.
Yes, explosive work is pretty good. I have to do most of that on the bike just because I've had pretty bad tendonitis the past 3 years since my past ACL surgery. But there's other ways to work around it. And I'd say it's important, but you also have to keep in mind you can overdo it with certain jumping training. And so I'd say the most important thing is to just make sure that you're keeping yourself in good health over being strong.
So that makes a lot of sense. So when you are back to skiing, when you're on the slopes again, who is your coach now?
Currently, I have two coaches. One of them is Simone Calisano. He's from Italy. And he was actually Charlie Guest's coach for a couple of years, which is where I first had him as my coach. I really liked him. And so I was asking Apex if they could bring him on. And my other coach is Lucy Brown, and she's from New Zealand. She's only a year older than me, but she has like a lot of good experience. And I think they make a pretty unique team, but I really like having both of them.
It's great to have them on board. Charlie Guest, many listeners will know, was Britain's, I guess, premier female slalom skier before she retired a couple of seasons ago. You also work with Apex in a team. What's the relationship with them?
Well, Apex is a huge part of, I'd say, my success for the past few years. They have a really cool setup where they're helping smaller countries that don't get as much funding. For example, one of my teammates is from Latvia. Her federation also doesn't have that much money to put her through a full season. And so Apex helps us out throughout the season, and they're also our team. It's a really cool setup.
So do you end up going out to team during the season? Because just to clarify, I guess the listeners probably don't know, but Apex is an amazing building. I saw it when I was there back in December. And effectively, it's a place where keen skiers can continue their education, but do their training at the same time, right?
Yeah, Apex is very cool. I didn't go to school there as like a high schooler, but it's still a really cool facility. They have like a lot of gym training stuff, and they get pretty late skiing, so you can train in the spring.
Well, it's an amazing building. If anyone is in team, they will notice it there. Am I right in thinking that maybe it's through them? Dave Riding has kind of worked as a mentor with you. You have conversations with him on a reasonably regular basis?
Yes, that's correct. Dave is involved with Apex, and so he mentors some of the athletes that are there, including me, for the past 2 years. And that has been a really cool experience. He just has a lot of knowledge, and something that I really admire is he has a lot of determination and never giving up. Like, it's pretty obvious when he's like one of the oldest slalom winners, and it just shows that if you're consistent and you're working hard, you can get to the top.
Sure. And you mentioned, the smaller ski nations, of which Great Britain is definitely one. His background, having come from, a small dry slope in Pendle, to be able to make that jump, and the consistency that he has managed, as you say, one of the oldest competitors on the World Cup circuit. That must be really invaluable, being able to tap into that.
Yeah, it's very cool. And it also is very helpful to help me keep things in perspective, because a lot of the time ski racing, like even at my age 24, you can feel like I haven't done enough yet in my career. Like, is it worth it to keep going? And Dave is just like a really good example that even if it's not happening for you right away, you can still make small steps every year to build up and to get where you want to be on World Cup.
For sure. I mean, I recall when I've chatted with the Carrick Smiths before, and I was looking at their record compared with his at the same age. It took a long time for him to make that breakthrough. He had loads of DNFs. He's now our leading athlete, and as I said, consistent. So you are our highest ranked female slalom skier just now. You mentioned Molly Butler, one of the youngsters also coming through. I think you're around 60th in the rankings at the moment. You mentioned about your dad giving you advice. Really breaking through to the top 30 is the key, because that's when you start to get a better start number. So what is it that you feel that you need to do to be able to make that breakthrough and get into the top 30?
Where I'm ranked right now is based off of FIS points, but getting into the top 30 in World Cup, that isn't based on FIS points at all. That's just based on getting enough World Cup points throughout the season to get in there. For that, I'd say the thing that I would really want to get this season is just momentum, because it can make a huge difference into getting one good result, building on it, and sort of becoming consistent. For example, I saw that with Charlie Guest in some of her seasons. Once you get the first top 30, it's like a lot easier. Once you get the top 30, it's easier to get into the top 20 and then into the top 15 because a huge part of the sport is confidence and just knowing that you can do it and trusting your skiing enough to basically let yourself do it, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. The confidence is a vital factor, but also that start number is really important as well. If you are in the top 30, you're going to start in the top 30, right? And that's a big advantage over starting at 50 or 60 or something like that. Well, I wish you all the best with that. We obviously have a Winter Olympics coming up. You competed at the World Championships last season. What do you need to do to qualify for Milan Cortina?
I think that the result at the World Champs helped. To really be solidified in, I do need to have two top 10 Europa Cup results or two top 30 World Cup results. And then from there, it's pretty complicated with how GB selects and sends people. So I'm not completely sure, which, to be honest, I don't think is the worst thing ever, because I've had seasons in the past where I'm like trying to hit certain numbers and I'm so focused on a certain result that I'm not able to focus on what I need to do to ski well. So my plan is just to sort of keep progressing my skiing without getting too zeroed in on certain results or the Olympics in general. But yeah, I would obviously love to go.
Well, as it goes, at Ski Launch, where I met Dennis, we had a panel where we were talking about the Winter Olympics, and your uncle Graham Bell was there and Shemi Alcott as well. And they were trying to explain to me how that qualifying procedure works. And it's evidently pretty complicated. So what I will do is wish you all the best for the forthcoming season and, you know, with your continued career. And hopefully we will see you competing for Team GB at Milano Cortina when we come to February 2026. Thank you very much, Rhys. If it's okay, I'm going to turn to Dennis now. Dennis, at Ski Launch, did a presentation about the future of snow sport. Now I have the benefit of having seen it already. I wondered if you could explain to the listener what Armana is hoping to do.
Yeah, so essentially what we do is we make ski lifts without cables. And usually when I say that, people go like, okay, that's interesting, but how? So the next sentence is pretty much autonomous vehicles that drive skiers uphill and then drive themselves back down. And these autonomous vehicles can take different shape, but essentially at the core, what we're proposing and what we're building and what we're doing is to make it possible for skiing to not be dependent on what I call a fixed supply solution, like a lift that just spins, right? It's just a cable that spins and spins. And it doesn't really matter how many people are in queue or if there's nobody there, it has to spin at the same time. And with Armana, you'd have a system that only travels when people are actually using it.
Yeah, actually, I might say at this point, listener, if you follow the Ski Podcast on social or on WhatsApp, you'll have already seen the Armana pods that Dennis is referring to, because I shared some photos. But if not, listener, why don't you just pause the podcast now, take the link in the show notes, have a look at a photo of what Armana are doing, and that will give you a much better idea of what we're talking about. But I think maybe, Dennis, it'd be useful to get an understanding of how it would work. Could you give us some applications for it, like when and where would you use the Armana system?
Yeah, so it'll be a while before they are ubiquitous. We are currently building our proof of concept vehicle for this winter season in the Northern Hemisphere. Next Northern season, so 26-27, is when the first vehicles will come on the snow. We're talking to people about that, of course, and then it will start going up. And the reason why I give you that like rundown of time, because there's many, many different application areas. Like, one of the challenges for Armana is that we have so many unique selling points, so many new and different ways to look at ski resorts, that, you know, cognitive overload is a very common condition when I speak to people. The way I see it, I think there's three main areas that it would develop. So the first one is the ski in, ski out area. So if you have a ski in, ski out chalet or a hotel or anything like that, that roughly doubles the value. Right. So if you have neighbors who are 200 meters down the road and they're not skiing, ski out, it's about half the value. So that would be one area.
By that, you're saying, right, you've got a property at the moment. It's near the slopes, but it's not actually on the slopes. But if you had a fleet of the Armana pods, autonomous vehicles, then they can actually connect their guests with the snow. It becomes ski in, ski out, and, you know, there's value for them there. Okay, so that's one of the things. What about the other idea?
Before I jump onto that, so what we're doing is we're mainly talking to housing organizations there, right? And that's a pretty easy proposition. And that would require maybe one or two, maybe three vehicles, right? So the next area of application is transports. So if you think about areas like Chamonix or Åre in Sweden, you have like these areas that would be great if they're connected, but they've been talking about building a lift for over a decade. It's never happening. And they could just deploy some vehicles to make that connection on the snow. So you don't have to go down to the bus route and go up into the next area, but you can actually find paths on the snow. So that's still not the exciting part in my mind. It's a very, very cool technology, and it will make the areas a lot bigger, and the flow of the skiers will be better, I think. But then the last area is, of course, the actual transportation of skiers instead of ski lifts. And I think that's where it will start with augmenting lifts. So, you know, there's a lot of favorite lifts that have a lot of wind closures, for example, and then you could like deploy these vehicles to augment them. So we have the very small resorts, and they tend to die because of climate change, and then having to replace the lift, not being able to bring up the capital expenditure, and then they have to close their location. With our vehicles, there is no capital expenditure. It's a transport as a service solution. So small resorts can just, you know, deploy vehicles. Depending on how many visitors they have, we can help them find the perfect solution. So the small resorts, mid-sized resorts, and we have new resorts or resorts that are looking to restart. And that's a completely different picture, because that would actually be full autonomy. So there would be no classical ski lifts. It would be full autonomy, especially for new resorts. That makes a lot of sense. And then the last one is, of course, existing mid-sized large resorts who are mainly looking at augmentation first. Those are the categories, I would say.
I suppose you could call it like a gondola on wheels. You know, there's seats inside for the skiers, it travels on the ground, and it's going to take you up the mountain. So evidently there's some routes where it wouldn't work, like, you know, you mentioned something like Agui de Midi. You're never going to get an automated vehicle to go up the Agui de Midi. But if you're in Maribel, for example, and right off the top of my head, possibly like Cobrun, you know, could be a good one. You know, the pylons are never massively high off the ground. It's a fairly straightforward route up to the top, so the vehicles would run on that route. And I think what struck me about it is that it's incredibly efficient. You talk about current lifts being very inefficient because they just run the whole time regardless of how many people are using them, right?
Yeah. When I started researching that, like I've also started skiing age three, like just like Reese, and I've never really considered it, but about 6 months ago I really started looking into the inefficiency of ski lifts. Ski lifts were invented before cars became mainstream. So the ski lifts were invented in 1908, and cars became mainstream in the 20s. And since then, we've sped up the cables, we've increased the capacity, and we've increased the safety, but essentially it's the same solution. Because it's a fixed supply solution, so it doesn't care about demand, most ski lifts run at less than 20% occupancy rate, which is quite mind-boggling. And like, a lot of ski resorts are looking at a four-season strategy to try and make money in the summer. But if you look at the occupancy rate for mountain biking, it's even lower. So you're stuck with this have to pay, have to run solution, even though there's three people on your mountain. So from that perspective, there's an enormous amount of efficiency. Also, if you look at the operational expenses of a ski resort, you have to even it out, because you can't, like, I can imagine that Reese, you and I will probably do a lot of runs in a day, but then there's somebody else who does two runs in a day, right? And how do you even that out? Well, with fixed supply solutions, you can't really get that number. So you never can get that efficiency number. And of course, the final part, or the I would say one of the most important parts, is for the environment, because our sport is hit by climate change extremely hard, and just having to run this system empty is wasteful. Also, building the system, of course, is destructive for the environment.
I mean, very valid points. I think in Larks, they have, it's one of the only places where they've got a lift that you can summon effectively, you know, call it to you. But otherwise, a lift runs regardless of what the occupancy is, how many people are on it. They're huge capital investments required of tens of millions of pounds when new lifts are brought in. And the other thing you mentioned as well, if we talk about, you know, these pods on the ground, they're much more secure in relation to the weather. For example, we often think of like chairlifts might have to close down, you know, in high winds. Assuming you would still want to go skiing in high winds, you'd be able to, you know, do it by this method.
Yeah, absolutely. So from a safety perspective, there's a couple of really interesting elements. First, these vehicles are stationary on entry and exit, and there's no lifts that do that. right? Now, maybe the Poma drag lifts where you pull the beam, you could say, okay, that's a stationary entry almost. But then you get catapulted as soon as the line grips, right? But so the vehicles are stationary on entry and exit. And actually, my sister, who's my co-founder, she had a horrible accident when she was like 9 years old in a ski lift, in a chairlift. And that really like ruined most of her ski career because she became scared of lifts. And a lot of people have that. So it's also not up in the air. It's based on the ground. And when I say autonomy, it's not like a robo-taxi that you see in LA or something like that, because it's a predefined route. The vehicles know exactly where to go and they're optimized to follow that route and to do object detection. Now, if something happens, all you have to do is open the door, or in another model where you still have your skis on, you just get off the bench and then you ski down and you take the next one. So when a ski lift stops, everybody stops. But when an Amana vehicle stops, you just ski down, get the next one.
I think, for, you know, you mentioned earlier, I can't remember what the phrase he used was, but it was a cognitive challenge to people to try and get their head around this, because it is so far outside. We talk about a new paradigm for lifts, you know, lifts without cables. And so some people find that difficult to imagine. But, you know, to me, it seems entirely feasible that it could work, you know, in the right circumstances. You mentioned that timeline earlier. Do you have a prototype yet? I can't recall what you said in relation to that.
No, we're building it right now. So the prototype will be on the snow this season. And the first vehicles, which currently looks to be anywhere between 20 and 40 vehicles, will be deployed in the 26-27 season. And the interesting thing is that if you buy a ski lift, like a chairlift or whatever, right, the build time is about 18 months. Don't talk about the legal time to actually get the permission to build it. That can easily be multiple decades, which is, of course, a problem you won't have with Armana, because you just deploy vehicles on the surface. But we're building these things now, and it will take about 18 months to get to actual production. But once we're in actual production, you'll order a vehicle and you'll have it like a couple of months later. And as production ramps up, you can deploy these vehicles when you want, where you want. So that's a pretty challenging thing for people to get their head around.
But it sounds super interesting. I'll be following it very keenly. I know you mentioned you're in your car in Germany at the moment, but you're from Sweden, aren't you? Is that where you will be trialing the first prototypes?
Yeah, so I'm originally Dutch, but I live in Sweden, and we are actually in the final stages of nailing down our production facility in more in the north of Sweden. So yeah, it's a great place, right? The mountains are not too high, but there's snow certainty, and we can find every angle we need.
Yeah, cool. Okay, well, and that's brilliant, Dennis. Thanks for sharing that with us. And you know, listeners, I'm going to put links to all of the things we discussed in the show notes. We're going to move towards a close now. I always enjoy listener feedback. Love to hear what you think about the show. You can leave me a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @theskipodcast, or you can drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. Now, we've had a few comments since the last episode. Mark Thomason enjoyed episode 256 when Bethany was talking about Tromsø in Norway. He let me know he was ski touring there in June. Great snow and amazing views, he said. James Rice said, I enjoyed episode 257. I was glad to hear you mention Robert Redford's recent death and his role in Downhill Racer. He goes on to say, however, Redford's influence on American skiing extends beyond that film. He goes on to mention his purchase of Sundance Ski Resort and setting up the film festival there. He says, I've had the chance to stay and ski at Sundance, and it truly is a distinctive and special place. I have watched that film since Robert Redford's passing. Really highly recommend it, Downhill Racer. It's a brilliant mix with real World Cup footage from the 60s. Story, the plot might be slightly predictable, but it's one of the best ski movies I've ever seen. John said, I love the Innsbruck Interroll episode. That was episode 257. Mary also enjoyed 257. She said, I enjoyed listening to the podcast this morning, particularly sections on Innsbruck. Thank you for reminding me how much I enjoyed the series The Jump. She also mentioned she'd been skiing with Peak Retreats regularly and is going to check out Ski Flight Free to find out about going by train for her next trip. There are now 275 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and a whopping 261 of those were listened to just in the last week. Now, when people start listening to the really old episodes, and we started in 2017, that normally means there's a new listener out there who's just binge listening and working their way through the whole lot. So if that's you, listener, I'm impressed. If you've enjoyed this episode, all you need to do is go to skipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find plenty more to listen to. In the last week, just over half of our listeners were in the UK, around 15% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Hong Kong, Tunisia, and Kazakhstan. You can follow me at Skipedia, the podcast at Ski Podcast. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of each podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. And if you'd like to help us, there are three things you can do. Follow us or subscribe so you never miss an episode. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts or a comment on Spotify. And if you're booking ski hire this winter, don't forget, you can save money on your ski hire with an additional discount by using the code SKIPODCAST when you book at insportrent.com. Simply take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Right. For now, I'd like to thank my guest today. Reese, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Dennis, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was great seeing you again.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.